This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Monday, the 28th of May. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Tom Morgan. Tonight on the show, we speak to ACON about a report released today shining a light on the suspected anti-gay homicides that occurred in New South Wales from the 1970s to the early 1990s, exploring the factors that enabled a culture of anti-gay violence to thrive in New South Wales during this time, as well as speak to Ambassadors and Bridge Builders International, who have released a report looking at gay conversion therapy in Australia, highlighting the realities of these so-called therapies of the past and the practices of the present within religious institutions.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
ACON is New South Wales' leading LGBTI health organisation. Its latest report, In Pursuit of Truth and Justice, documenting the gay and transgender prejudice killings in New South Wales in the late 20th century, shines a light on the suspected anti-gay homicides that occurred in New South Wales from the 1970s to the early 1990s. The report explores the factors that enabled a culture of anti-gay violence to thrive in New South Wales during this period. The report also brings to the fore the failures of the criminal justice system at the time and highlights the lasting effects these shortcomings have had on members of the LGBT community. Importantly, the report presents a series of recommendations aimed at achieving justice and healing for victims and survivors, enhancing current responses to hate crimes, and strengthening ongoing efforts to violence prevention. Now on The Informer, Dean Arcuri and Rachel Tyler-Jones speak with ACON Safety, Inclusion and Historic Injustice Project Manager Michael Atkinson to find out more about the report and what steps we can take to not only heal the wounds of the past, but get some justice as well.
How did ACON go about compiling the data for the report, which documents 20 years of anti-gay and transgender homicides?
We relied completely on public sources of information. So we went to coroners, courts, other courts. So we got unreported findings from different justice-related courts. We searched far and wide through media, press clippings, a range of academic sources, including Stephen Thompson, who's locally a well-regarded criminologist, and as well Australia and internationally. So, yeah, we've scoured far and wide for information.
It's an incredibly detailed report, so that must have been a lot of information from a lot of different sources.
It was not hard, though, in as much that whilst some of the cases we weren't able to find detailed information, there was a lot of information available on many of the cases, so it was very easy to start to see trends and common issues and occurrences and experiences of men and transgender women, which, as the report shows, was horrifying. For many of these people, their last moments would have been absolutely shocking and fearsome.
Michael, why is it important to bring up such painful and distressing events from the past as you have for this report?
ACON has worked, as many organisations across Australia and internationally, have worked in the area of safety and violence prevention. And we have been in touch with hundreds, if not thousands, of community members who continue to be impacted today. And the legacy of violence, it just has left such a deep impact for people. So those people particularly who experienced violence back in the 70s, 80s, even further back, who are still alive today, it's very real. The impact continues. You know, so many people continue to experience post-traumatic stress disorder. Many people's lives were impacted at the time. People feared coming out, reporting to police, going to health, like hospitals, for fear of being outed. And as a result of reporting, sometimes people lost jobs, people's relationships with their families were impacted. Yeah, so those people are still alive today, and the concern, people's concern for violence today is still real. So yeah, so absolutely, looking to the future, we need to continue to work with the police and other government agencies who are very willing to work into the future to improve responses and support and to prevent violence into the future.
Just looking a little bit at what the report was actually covering, could you maybe just flesh out for us what makes something a hate crime?
Broadly speaking, if there's clear evidence that a crime was motivated by a prejudice towards a minority group or a particular, so for example, a religious group, so whether it also it can be a race-based motivation, and it's very hard sometimes to prove hate crimes. For example, a perpetrator might have been heard using language, they may have left certain pieces of evidence at the scene of the crime, certain locations. So, for example, in gay hate crimes, given the fact that many of the murders covered in this report occurred at beats or places which were known to publicly, where gay men frequented. Australia doesn't have a very clear reporting or assessment tool, and that's one of the things that we're calling for.
My understanding is that, in general, when it comes to violent crime, including homicide, the perpetrator is known to the victim. So I was quite surprised to read that one of the three key findings from your report was that, in general, in the cases that you looked at, there was little or no pre-existing relationship between the assailants and their victims. Why do you think this series of crimes is so different from the norm in that respect?
This is common with hate crimes. Generally, the person's motivation is very different. So, yes, generally homicides, the people are known to each other, and there's either, you know, motivations such as revenge and other types of similar motivations. Whereas quite often in hate-based crimes, the perpetrator holds very strong views. It really conflicts with their views. Often it is the case that they will strike out at someone who's not known to them.
The report seeks to deliver justice for victims and survivors. What would you consider justice to be? What solution would that be?
Well, that really would depend on listening to survivors. ACON, for example, we plan to continue to listen to survivors. We'll be holding a range of events coming into the future, panel discussions, consultations and events to engage the community around this important topic, because I think it would completely depend. So some individuals feel strongly about an apology from the New South Wales government, for example, ranging right through to some individuals, you know, for whom they lost a loved one. Nothing's going to change their grief. And I think just some form of acknowledgement. So, for example, the Bondi Memorial, Waverley Council have very generously approved to support ACON to build a monument out at Bondi. And I think creating a space where people can go to reflect on the memories of their loved ones, it is about moving forward and creating a stronger, more inclusive community.
The report calls for a formal apology by New South Wales Parliament and New South Wales Police for the inadequate and slow responses to homophobic and transphobic hate-motivated violence during this period. And we've just been discussing how much healing can really happen with an apology. But looking at past circumstances where we've had apologies in this case, do you feel like it can help bridge a gap and change the divide that exists?
Absolutely. So some of the other recommendations that we've got in the report include conducting further research to fully understand the extent of violence that happened in the past, as well to involve New South Wales Police in further processes to support people who come forward with evidence. I think an apology will help to bridge that gap and help people to think, okay, this is being taken seriously by government and by police, and I can feel comfortable to come forward with more information about my experiences from the past, because this report only details 88 cases. We know that there were many more cases of violence that were experienced by our whole community. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, intersex, queer. Our community experienced prolonged and quite severe violence. And I think absolutely there needs to be that relationship, that ongoing relationship with police, and people need to feel they can trust in order to come forward.
You're listening to Joy 94.9, and we're talking to ACON Safety in Inclusion and Historic Injustice Project Manager Michael Atkinson.
And we're discussing the report released by ACON today, In the Pursuit of Truth and Justice, documenting gay and transgender prejudice killings in New South Wales in the late 20th century, which shines a light on the suspected anti-gay homicides that occurred in New South Wales from the 1970s to the early 1990s.
Michael, have you had a response to the report yet from New South Wales Police or the New South Wales Government?
No, we haven't. It's too early just yet.
Obviously, this report covers crimes that were perpetrated up to the early 1990s. How has the LGBTI community's relationship with the New South Wales Police changed since then?
I think with the advent of the Gay Lesbian Liaison Officer Program, which was instituted in the 1990s, which ACON was fortunate enough to play a role in establishing, and Sue Thompson was the instigator of the list of the 88 crimes that are in the report. In that sense, the New South Wales Police Force and individuals within have really led the process. So it is critical. So the relationship is really important. The GLOWS, for example, just as one example, they are incredible champions for change and for helping their colleagues to understand our communities, to understand our needs, to champion diversity and inclusion within the police force, because it helps people to, when police officers are out working and dealing with our community, when we're reporting crimes, whether they're violent crimes or otherwise, it's really important that every police officer can understand our needs. There has been a lot of change, but absolutely there is more change to come in terms of systemic changes, so ongoing reporting of bias crimes or hate crimes. There needs to be a new system. There needs to be a very clear system that our community understands and thinks, okay, yes, that system is worth me engaging with to report my crime, because many people today still experience concern for outing themselves to police and other authorities. There's room for ongoing improvement.
Michael, in New South Wales, this kind of report and this kind of documentation that we've heard about for a while shows a lot of the mistrust that a lot of young people within our communities can have. Last week in Victoria, the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officers brought out a report that highlighted the fact that while the police are doing the work that they can, the reality is that for many in our communities, they still have a lot of mistrust when it comes forward to the police, because it's built into our history that there's been a lot of violence against us. And this report shows this as well. What can we say to our community to show that we're not only working to change that, but building the structures to create things and make better?
Firstly, just want to acknowledge that report. It's a fantastic report, and I believe it was commissioned by the Victorian Police. So there is a concerted effort coming from within government and within police to champion the cause and to respond to the advocacy that's coming from within our community. So that report had a range of recommendations, of which I just think are all fantastic, and many of which we had considered and some we included in our report. So, for example, third-party reporting mechanisms. That's an example of a way that if you experience a hate crime and if you feel an element of reservation about reporting it directly to police, there's international examples, particularly in the Kingdom and in Scotland, where there's different systems where, so for example, organisations like ACON can represent or support individuals to report a hate crime. So these are systems that are particularly good for young people. I think today, it's still difficult to come out for a lot of people. That journey to come to terms with your own gender or sexuality, it's real. And so whether you're interacting with a health service provider, whether you're interacting with, family members, friends, schoolmates, it's still difficult to tell people and to have that concern about being outed or people's negative reactions. So any system that can assist someone who has experienced a hurtful crime is welcomed.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight on The Informer.
That was Dean Arcuri and Rachel Taylor-Jones speaking with ACON Safety Inclusion and Historic Injustice Project Manager Michael Atkinson. A link to the full report can be found via ACON's website or via our social media. The Bondi Memorial, mentioned in the interview, honours and remembers those lost to gay and trans hate violence, and you can find out more about it or donate via bondimemorial.com.au.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Do you know the difference between religious conversion therapy and conversion therapy? Is there a difference? Do you actually understand what conversion therapy is, or just what we see in the headlines? Ambassadors and Bridge Builders International have released a detailed report looking at gay conversion therapy in Australia, to not only combat some of the misinformation we are seeing in the media, but also to help clear up the conversation, highlighting the realities of these so-called therapies of the past and practices of the present within religious institutions. The ABBI serves individuals, churches, denominations, leaders, and religious organisations in a respectful and non-confrontational way along their journey to understand LGBTI people, their community, and relationships. Dean Arcuri sat down with ABBI founder Anthony Venn Brown to discuss the report and the realities we aren't noticing when it comes to religious conversion therapy.
You've recently, through ABBI, have released a really, really detailed report about religious conversion therapy in Australia. So why was it important to release that information now?
You know, I've been writing on the topic for many years, and this journey began for me in 2000 when I had a online Yahoo group of ex-gay survivors, we call the people which have been through ex-gay programs. So I'm currently writing a book on the topic called The Quest to Cure Queers, which is why I'm in Europe at the moment, doing further research and then going to the US. So it was really important, considering now that the whole thing is happening about wanting to ban gay conversion therapy, it's really important to educate and inform people what this is about, because I was seeing that people are making the same mistakes that happened in the past, that people needed to, first of all, really understand what are we talking about when we're talking about gay conversion therapy. This is a very recent term.
I do think one of the important things about the report that you've released, it's so detailed. It deals with history, different countries, so many different narratives that we see, but it really does talk about the media regarding religious gay conversion therapy or gay conversion therapy and the confusion that's being created. How do you think we can break that down to not only better inform but better communicate?
I think that one of the things that would really be helpful, Dean, is if we could have a standard term to separate the things that we're talking about. Because I think within the LGBTI community, if people don't come from a faith background, then they may have as much misunderstanding and misinterpretation of really what's going on as well. So having a term would be very, very useful. But we probably need to have more of a conversation about that. But that's one thing that I highlight at the beginning of the report. We need to get our terms right so we know really what are we talking about here. And the media needs to take more responsibility. I think in my report, I quoted actually an article from, I believe it was the Washington Post, which had just done the very thing that I had condemned, you know, had spoken about, that they had said about gay conversion therapy. Then they talked about electric shock treatment and vomit-inducing drugs, but that's nothing to do with what was happening in Washington at that point. So it was irresponsible of them to use that. It's sensational and got people emotional about it, but it wasn't actually staying on topic.
So one of the things you speak about a lot and you put a lot of detail into in the piece is talking about religious gay conversion therapy as opposed to gay conversion therapy. Why is it important for us to understand the difference in that distinction?
Very important for us to understand that distinction, because they're two very, very different things. The term gay conversion therapy is a relatively new term, Dean, and it's become very, very popular. It has been used to talk about what have been dated medical practices from the past, such as aversion therapy, like electroshock treatment, and also vomit-inducing drugs being injected in different people while they watch photographs. So there are old methodologies which may be happening in other countries. And then, of course, within the mental health profession, there would be some very dated practitioners in that who would still maybe believe that homosexual is caused by an improper upbringing and that they could translate. So that's very different from the religious context. So within the religious context, to use the term gay conversion therapy is problematic because, number one, it's not therapy. People aren't going to, as they would to a medical health professional, they're going to a pastor, a Christian leader, or some ministry which will pray, which will offer spiritual advice. And this is based upon the Bible and their own personal experience as opposed to any reputable mental health research.
Religion plays a huge part in religious conversion therapy. And today, I don't think the way in which we're seeing the topic played out in the media or in conversations, whether it be political or in other ways, they're really focusing on the narrative in that way. Do you think we need to be able to create a deeper understanding of faith alongside sexuality so that we actually can build a stronger dialogue here rather than throwing things over a fence, as it were?
Well, I think we do need to be very careful about the terminology we use, and particularly, you know, like I know that some people in the media have gone to previous what we would call ex-gay organisations leaders of that and saying to them, do you do conversion therapy? Of course, their response would be no, because they've read the articles which talk about electric shock treatment and starvation and deprivation, and there were some very cruel things that happened, but often those have either been in the past or are very, very extreme cases, and not many people in Australia have experienced that at that level. But within the religious context, there's a whole different thing going on because the person of faith, their faith is very important to them, their whole social network, their friends, their family, maybe even their education is within that context, and they've never heard anything positive about what it means to be gay or lesbian or trans. And so, you know, we need to be working more on educating people around the areas of belief around sexuality and gender identity.
One of the important things that you do highlight in the report is the Christian Counsellors Association of Australia's Code of Ethics changing. And it's so interesting when you look at the way in which that's occurred, but also when you realise it's not actually taking effect in the way that one would hope it to.
No, it is astounding. I think it's astounding, and I'm not quite sure why other media sources have not picked this up, but it's astounding that the Christian Counsellors Association of Australia have actually changed their code of ethics, which says that none of their practitioners are to do any orientation or gender modification approaches. So within the Christian Counsel Association, you get such a spectrum of people, and there are people within that who still very, very strongly believe in a Christian version of gay conversion therapy, you know, that they believe, number one, that this is something that is caused by an incorrect upbringing or by sexual abuse, and so that their development has been arrested. And that through therapy, they can change that. And also with, you know, they believe through the power of prayer and faith as well. But it's their Christian beliefs mixed in with their counselling practice.
I think what's really interesting is the only reason we know about this in this kind of detail is because your report. It hasn't been seen in other media spaces, at least here within Australia, and it's so important. But do you think that's because people shied away from the attention or didn't put focus on it, or we just weren't looking?
Probably all of those things, Dean. But the main thing is that the Christian Counsellors Association do not want to get involved in a public dialogue on this and do not want to get involved in controversy. And that's the main reason why they've hidden it. That's the main reason why they didn't want to talk to me originally when they were discussing this. But now it's out and they have said it and they have to live by it. And I guess it's then now, we've highlighted that in the report, it's only a matter of time before somebody goes to someone who is accredited with the Christian Counselling Association of Australia, who has a counsellor saying to them, look, you know, now I can help you with your unwanted same-sex attraction, which is the term that they would use, and that they will be reported.
So looking at the landscape as you have, you've created an incredibly detailed report that gives us not only a lot of information to think of how we're approaching this, both in conversation and dialogue, but where we're really looking at information. What advice would you give for tackling this and taking the next step? Because there's so many different levels and layers that you approach, but it does really show that there's a huge change that we have to make to really think about how we're engaging and putting a stop to this.
I mean, obviously, one thing that would be helpful for people is exactly what you've done, Dean, and that's read the report, because it is very in-depth, it is very detailed. I mean, I would say over 70% of that has been unpublished work, and I highlight all the important things moving forward. But, you know, we've had our battle with marriage equality, and this seems to be our next battle. And we do really need to think strategically about how we do this. We need to do it in a very, very educated way. I think we need to work collaboratively on this, and that hasn't always been something that's happened within this space, sadly, because a lot of the ex-gay survivors, in fact, I'd say most of the ex-gay survivors, we have some level of PTSD, and we can trigger easy and we can bounce off each other, but we really do need to work collaboratively on this.
That was Dean Arcuri with Anthony Venn Brown, founder of Ambassadors and Bridge Builders International. You can find a copy of the report on our social media or via abbi.org.au.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. Don't forget to follow us on social media, at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Tom Morgan.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.